The clerk will call the next case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Doe, et cetera, versus Baker and others. Jeffrey R. Adams, Lucas I. Pangle, Appellants Counsel, Deborah E. S. Kane, John L. Cooley, Jr., Appellees Counsel.
Mr. Adams, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I am Jeffrey Adams, and I represent Jane Doe. Jane was sexually assaulted by Pastor Jonathan King when she was a 13-year-old schoolgirl. Moreover, as she alleges in her amended complaint, the Church of God and the Virginia Church of God and their individual agents hired King as the pastor of the congregation Jane attended and licensed him as an ordained minister, knowing full well that he was a sexual predator and that their employment of him presented an unreasonable risk to Jane and others like her. Despite the clear and sufficient allegations in Jane's amended complaint, the trial court granted the appellee's demurrer on the ground that, as a matter of law, Jane's injuries were not proximately caused by appellee's conduct. This was clear error, as it misconstrued the facts as pled by Jane and misapplied relevant law. That error denied Jane the opportunity to pursue discovery in this matter and to place her claims before a jury. In her opening brief, Jane conceded that her special relationship claims, failure to warn and failure to protect, were not well pled in light of this court's recent decision of A.H. versus Church of God, which was rendered after she filed that amended complaint. Appellees, not satisfied with that concession, attempt to impose the pleading requirements of special relationship claims on all of Jane's claims. In particular, they assert that Jane's claims that sound in negligence fail for lack of a pled special relationship. That assertion is squarely at odds with this court's opinion in Church of God, which explicitly distinguishes special relationship claims from claims that sound in negligence. Liability under the special relationship theory is grounded, unsurprisingly, in the existence of a special relationship, a relationship assumed by a defendant vis-a-vis a plaintiff. Liability under negligent hiring and retention, on the other hand, is grounded in foreseeability, the foreseeable risk courted by a defendant who knowingly hires or retains an employee who poses a danger to others. The claims are conceptually distinct and are subject to different pleading requirements. Thus, in the prior Church of God case, this court's analysis of the plaintiff's negligent retention claim did not address at all the lack of a sufficiently pled special relationship. On the contrary, the plaintiff's claims sounding in negligence were dismissed, but were dismissed due to a lack of sufficient allegations to establish that the risk posed by the employee in question was in fact foreseeable. In light of Jane's concession that her special relationship claims were not well pled, the question of whether Jane adequately pled a special relationship has no further relevance to her appeal. Now, moving on to her other claims, perhaps the
counsel,
most egregious error.
Yes, counsel, Your Honor? May I ask you this question? There seems to be a split of authority with respect to negligent hiring, with some courts saying once you're no longer employed, that claim is no longer viable. And then other courts saying, well, it may be viable, particularly if the claim is rooted in something that happened or began during the employment relationship. And obviously, you would need us to accept the latter, that the claim remains viable, notwithstanding the end of at least formal employment. So help me with navigating these divergent strands of authority.
Certainly, Your Honor. As a preliminary matter, and we'll come back to this, we certainly believe that there was an adequate pleading of employment and agency. But assuming that employment and agency ultimately cannot be proved, with regard to the negligent hiring and retention, I think the best way to understand that is there are two conceptual ways that those sorts of claims have been articulated by courts. In one, the emphasis is on control. And that's what you see in California, in Ohio, and ultimately stemming from Section 317 of the Restatement. And that is really a claim in which the allegation is that the employer has not adequately controlled the employee knowing that the employee posed a potential risk, and therefore, really the breach is the failure to control. Well, obviously, if there's no employment or agency relationship, then there's no capacity to control, therefore there can be no duty. And in that line of cases, the courts have pretty consistently said that when it's operating under those that theory, then negligent hiring and retention or those similar sorts of claims, although they really start to look like negligent supervision, but they cannot be maintained if the individual was not in fact an employer agent at the time of the actual injury.
What this court has done, may I inject something right there? But we specifically held, based upon prior precedent, there is no negligent supervision tort. There's a negligent hiring tort, there's a negligent retention tort. And the negligent retention tort basically says, look, if you've got someone who's that bad, you better fire him. How is that logically consistent with, yeah, and after you fire him, you're going to be liable indefinitely for any horrible thing he or she did after you fire him?
Well, I don't follow
the logic of that.
Well, the logic is exactly that this court has rejected negligent supervision, and it's rejected Section 317 of the restatement. And so the emphasis isn't on control, but on foreseeability. And with regard to this idea of liability without limit and liability for all time, I think what we would say is two things. That it's not that the liability is unlimited, but the proper governor are these two factual questions. One is foreseeability. Does hiring that person create a foreseeable risk? And is that risk foreseeable even after employment, given the nature of the relationship?
May I interrupt you one more time? Because I want to drill down on this point. There's only two torts. You shouldn't have hired him. You should fire him. There's your two torts. Negligent hiring, negligent retention. That has nothing to do with what happens after he's fired, or if you didn't hire him. So there's a conceptual break. You go to foreseeability and jump right over duty, which is happening almost on a ubiquitous level in modern legal discourse. But that you went right to foreseeability and causation, and you haven't addressed duty in your analysis. So imagine I'm an employer, and I've got a bad employee. And if I keep that employee on my payroll, something bad is going to happen to somebody, and I'm going to be properly found at fault for negligent retention. What is my obligation? My duty is to fire him. I'm not supposed to hire somebody to track him down for the next 20 years. I need to get him out of my shop so he doesn't do anything on my clock. So how does that square with your argument?
Well, we think we don't jump past duty, but we believe the duty exists. The duty attaches when that individual is known by the employer to present that risk. And the way that the employer prevents liability is by promptly discharging that individual. And that's what this court has said. The danger is, you know, in this case, you have someone who became known to be a threat for a long period of time in a relationship of intimacy and authority, including with minors and young people. And I think you need to flip it on its head. They continue to allow those relationships to grow and strengthen, knowing that to the extent that he was in that position of authority and trust with families and young people, he was in a position to continue his sexual predation. So we would argue that absolutely there is a duty. The duty attaches when the employer becomes aware of the foreseeable and unreasonable risk. And at that point...
So the foreseeability in your analysis is he may commit a tort later. There's no doubt that if the employee creates a tort during the term of employment, there's a duty and that all the consequent remedies are required. But you're saying that because this particular victim was not victimized during the term of formal employment, I'm not arguing your point about that you pled post-retirement employment. I think that's a good point. But I am suggesting I don't understand how there can be a duty at all in perpetuity when the tort exists after the employer does the very thing the law says he needs to do, which is fire the guy.
Well, what I would say is this, Your Honor. What the law says he should do is fire him promptly upon notice. What happened in this case isn't they didn't fire him. They retained him for years while complaints piled up on their desks. and then eventually allowed him to retire with his credential as a minister intact. And so this is not a case where the employer sort of did the right thing and is being punished for that. And as far as duty, I agree there's not a duty after employment. Let's concede employment ended at some point. I agree there isn't a duty after employment, but the point that I think we would make is there's nothing to suggest that, that breach and injury have to happen contemporaneously. So there was a duty at the time that the Church of God became aware that this man was a sexual predator, and the duty was to promptly terminate him. They chose not to do that, and that was their breach. And the breach was complete. The duty was present, the duty was not fulfilled, and a breach was complete at time one. At that point, we believe that the question is, any harm that arguably arose as a result of that breach that happened at time one, can that be proximately traced back to that breach? And so our argument was we had a duty and we had a breach when he was conceitedly, by all parties, an employee. The Church of God became aware he was a sexual predator, and they didn't do what the law required, which would be to discharge him under negligent hiring and retention. And at this point, what we have at time two, which is when the injury took place, we have an injury that's proximately caused by that breach.
Suppose he hadn't retired. Suppose the people in charge had decided, we've had it with this guy, we're going to fire him. If I understand the logic of what you're saying, 15 years after they fire the guy, he does something wicked, and it involves someone that he met during the term of employment and allegedly groomed. They're liable for that.
Not at all, Your Honor. And the reason is this. If they promptly fired him, there's no breach. The duty attached when they became aware of the risk he posed, if they met that duty by promptly firing him, then there's no breach, and so you can't trace an injury to a breach, and so there's no liability.
So, but you only promptly fire him after he's done something really wicked. You can't just throw people out thinking that they're wicked and there's no evidence of it. So, your whole argument circles and collapses upon itself if the triggering event for the duty is knowledge of something that he's done that's wicked, because then the employer becomes indefinitely liable for everything, whether it keeps them on the clock or doesn't keep them on the clock.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor, on this point. Under vicarious liability, the employer may be liable for whatever he does if it's within the scope of employment. But under negligent hiring and retention, the liability only attaches when the employer becomes aware of the risk. And so if there's a first incident and that occurs, under vicarious liability, there's an analysis, okay, was that within the scope of employment? Is the employer vicariously liable? But under negligent hiring and retention, that first incident, if there's no other notice, the employer has not been on notice, there's no foreseeability of the risk, at that point, there can't be any liability. And if the employer then does the right thing, determines this person poses a risk and acts promptly on it, I think the defense attaches that there was a duty, certainly, and the duty was completely fulfilled, and therefore there's no breach and therefore no liability. And I think that's the important thing about teasing out and distinguishing between the vicarious liability claims and the negligence claims. Because again, the negligence claims do not necessarily make the employer liable for whatever this individual does. It's a question of, did they have adequate information? Was it foreseeable that he posed that unreasonable risk? And only then.
But your whole argument on negligent, your argument on negligent hiring is they had information the second before they hired him. They had enough information that he was going to be a predator, and they should have never hired him. It was their duty not to hire him. It was negligent to hire him. Well, the moment they hire him, under that theory, under your theory, I know you're not conceding this, they're now liable for everything that he ever does later, because it's foreseeable, because they never should have hired him in the first place, because he's a bad guy.
Well, so I wouldn't say
that is
I
an extreme say, form of tort liability.
To, I wouldn't my, say everything, Your Honor. I would say everything that's foreseeable. In this example, again, we're talking about someone who is a known sexual predator engaging in sexual predation. If someone is an embezzler and they commit arson, if someone is, you know, it's not, again, vicarious liability where we're saying, in a sense, whatever he does, if it's in the scope of employment, there's liability. It's a question of, is there foreseeability? And if the answer to that is yes, then the obligation to fire or to not hire, if the person hasn't been retained, attaches. And at that point, yes, there's liability for any foreseeable harm that arises out of that breach, the breach that happened when they failed to do their duty and either fire or not hire the individual.
Can I ask you just it's a minor point, but what is the significance of the fact that he retained a license? And the analogy that I thought of is, suppose you have a lawyer who's a sexual harasser, and then he retires from a law firm, and maybe he comes in every once in a while to help out with something. The fact that he retains a law license is just, it seems like it's neither here nor there. But that may operate differently in your this denomination's context. So what is the significance of that? Because that's something that comes up, that he still had his minister's license.
Well, keep does in
that
mind,
matter?
I think it does. The first thing to say is we're at the pleading stage, that my client's entitled to the benefit of her pleadings and any reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that. I think ordination, certainly there's the inference that it's different from a law license in several regards. One is a law license is merely a credential in general. In other words, the bar of law examiner says, I am licensed to practice law. It doesn't really identify any organic relationship between the Board of Law Examiners and me. It doesn't, although one similarity is, it does give it a disciplinary authority over me. And I think that's relevant to the question of agency. To what extent was there continuing oversight and disciplinary authority over this individual because of his retained ordination? To what extent did he have obligations? To what extent would his ministry be imputed by a reasonable person to be ministry not just of an individual, but of the Church of God, going to the question of parent agency? And so, and it goes back to the fact that that's a thorny factual question, which isn't really appropriate to be answered on a demur, and isn't appropriate to be answered without availing my client of discovery.
Counsel, is there a time limitation on your negligent retention and foreseeability connection? We know, for example, with sexual predators and pedophiles, those people tend to reoffend probably in perpetuity. So would your position be that by not terminating someone quickly enough, if they are the type of offender who continues to offend into the future, that employer would remain liable because you would say it would be foreseeable that a pedophile is always a pedophile?
I would say two things to that, Your Honor. It's not unlimited in two regards. One is that, let's assume there's some question about how quickly the employer terminated the individual. Although this is not that case. I mean, this individual was allowed to continue as an ordained minister, as an employee, for years after the Church of God received complaints from his own daughters, among others, multiple written, specific, graphic complaints. But there are two limitations on this. First, I would say time is not a per se rule. I don't think any court can say as a matter of law, 1 year is too much, but 2 years is not, or vice versa. I think it's relevant to the question of proximate cause. Is there still a proximate causation that can be established here? And that's, the burden is on my client when she gets to trial. The other thing is, and you see this in many denominations, a denomination can take affirmative acts to try to break that chain of causation. They can, for example, provide a list of individuals who've been credibly alleged to have committed sexual predation, so that people are on notice of the risk and aren't necessarily going to assume that the licensure or the ordination confers a kind of imprimatur on that individual. They can inform specifically members of the congregations that they serve. They can direct them not to continue in ministry, and they can direct congregations not to permit them to do that. And so there are a number of things that cabin this potential liability that mean it's not unlimited, and that protect the public, that protect young women like Jane, who was placed in a relationship of trust, a relationship of authority with an individual who is a known sexual predator. And we know that predators use time to groom their victims. And in this case, the fact that it took time for him to groom Jane, we believe, does not prevent her from asserting her claims. Certainly, it doesn't mean that those claims are deficient as a matter of law at the pleading stage.
All right, Justice Powell, has he answered your question?
Yes, Chief, thank you.
All right, your time has expired. With regard to the appellee's case, each side in this case have had 20 minutes allotted. The 20 minutes just has expired for the appellant Doe. Appellee has divided their argument. The the Church of God, the National Church of God, will have 5 minutes. And that argument will be made by Ms. Kane. The Virginia Church of God and individual defendants at the trial level will be represented by Mr. Cooley. Mr. Cooley, you go first for 15 minutes. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the court, my name is John Cooley, and I represent the Virginia Church of God and the five individual named defendants in this matter who had various positions within the Virginia Church of God. As the court's aware, Pastor King was called to Celebration Church in 1995 and retired in 2011. The alleged abuse involving Jane Doe occurred approximately 5.5 years after his retirement in July of 2016.
So this is Justice Kelsey. The amended complaint directly alleges that he was an employee or agent at the time of the offense. Now, that may be completely false factually, or it may be completely correct factually, but that's not something we decide on demur, is it?
Your Honor, if the amended complaint provides allegations that in essence rebut the presumption that would be there of employment, vicarious liability, etc., then the court can consider that. For example, the amended complaint specifically states that in paragraph 17 that King retired or served from 1995 until 2011 as pastor. Paragraph 40, he announces his retirement, which occurs in April of 2011. Paragraph 43 and 44, he stepped down as pastor. And significantly, paragraph 47 specifically says he left his former employment. Whether they plead or Doe pleads that he was an employee, paragraph 47 specifically says that he left his former employment.
That clause in context to suggest he left his prior full-time employment as a pastor. And the nuance they're trying to assert, or did assert, is but there still was, after that leaving the formal full-time employment, there was still an employment relationship of some type. Now, that may be completely factually unprovable, but that's what they have alleged, and the trial judge didn't do a real summary judgment. The trial judge did a pleading analysis.
That's correct, Your Honor, but there are no pleadings within the amended, or no facts within the amended complaint as to how, in light of paragraph 47, how he continued his employment. And no facts to indicate that he continued his employment, or any facts to indicate that, as far as the Virginia Church of God is concerned, that there was any relationship between the Virginia Church of God and King at all, if any, after 2011. So while it's an allegation, at best, it's a conclusory allegation and is contrary to the remaining allegations in the complaint. And we would suggest to the court that Doe can't have it both ways. Doe can't claim that he is a pastor and he retired from pastorate and that he left employment and that there are former congregants and still claim that he is an employee, which Your Honor raises the whole perspective here of we have a conglomerate of allegations naming individual defendants. And if I might just briefly address the individual defendants, there are five of them, two of which are listed as district overseers. They have no authority. They cannot appoint. They cannot remove. In fact, Doe pleads in paragraph 15 that only state overseers can appoint or remove. So the extent to which Robertson or Jamies, who are listed as district overseers, are in this case, there is no basis in the amended complaint to keep them in the case, and they were appropriately dismissed. The three individual defendants who are state superintendents, or they're called bishops now, the first is Mr. Gunter, and he only served in 1995 up until 1997. Anything that is after that date, and even the negligent hiring that allegedly occurred raises questions about him. In addition, the negligent hiring, negligent retention are primary, it relates to primary liability for the employer and not the individuals. And therefore, the allegations involving negligent hiring and retention as against the individual defendants is inappropriate, and they were appropriately dismissed. Plaintiff has admitted in their opening brief as well as in their reply brief that there is no special relationship. However, if there is no special relationship, then there is no duty here involving the negligence or tort-based claims. So whether it's a duty to warn or a duty to protect, the remaining tort-based claims are based upon the individual defendants failing to warn or failing to protect, whether it's willful and punitive damages or negligent infliction or fraud by omission with a duty to disclose. As to all of those individual defendants, there is no duty because there is no duty to warn, duty to protect, and all of those claims are based on whether or not there is a special relationship. That raises, Your Honor, as you, Justice Kelsey, pointed out, raises the issue of negligent hiring and negligent retention. And as to negligent hiring, the duty applies at the time of the actual hiring. Now, there may be some question when the hiring occurred, whether it was in 67 when King became licensed or credentialed and a pastor of other churches, or in 95 when he came to Celebration Church, assuming it's 95 when he came to Celebration Church, the only allegation involving negligent hiring is that there was inappropriate behavior occurring at two prior churches with no indication of what that quote inappropriate behavior was, or how the Virginia Church of God would have known about the inappropriate behavior. And the first notice to the Virginia Church of God that's pled is a letter that's sent in 1996 that in essence gives an opinion that King is lost in sin, and that's the extent of it. There's another letter in 1997 that says King should stop writing her, please stop King from writing her, and there are no more complaints involving that. So if negligent hiring attaches at the time of the hiring, and there is no notice to Virginia Church of God, and nothing pled regarding anything that Virginia Church of God knew or should have known at that time, then there's no basis for the negligent hiring. In addition, how can there be any foreseeability from 1995 to 2016 when this alleged event occurred involving Jane Doe, that is 21 years after the hiring that's pled? That raises then the issue of negligent retention. And Justice Kelsey, you and the other justices' questions raise an important point here. How can the Virginia Church of God, who has no duty to protect or duty to warn, and the other negligence claims are based on that, and the only thing remaining is negligent retention, how can they, when they don't control and they don't have custody, foresee that someone that's retired and 5.5 years after the retirement, with no allegations in terms of how Virginia Church of God controls, knows, anything else, how are they going to foresee that he's going to specifically abuse a 13-year-old girl at that time? The time frame is too far attenuated between his retirement and the time of this event of over almost 5.5 years. And we would suggest to the court that that is too far, too attenuated, imposes significant liability, and as questioning indicated to counsel, at what point does the difference between any duty to terminate and an employee is no longer an employee, not an agent, no allegations to at all to support that, how far does it extend? What if this were 10 years later?
Does it
extend that far? We would suggest to the court that it does not extend that far. And as a result, the court below appropriately dismissed.
Mr. Cooley. Justice Powell has a question.
Thank you, Chief. Counsel, there is an allegation that your client maintained his license. Is there some connection between retaining the license and the ability of the church to control their behavior?
Your Honor, raises a constitutional issue that's not raised here. As a church, there are First Amendment issues involved with who is a minister, who is not a minister, what is done with the minister, not done with the minister. The significant thing is the last alleged complaint occurred in 2005. There is nothing from 2005 all the way up to 2011 alleged. There is nothing that's alleged that occurred between 2011 and 2016. So to have, in essence, defrocked King of his license would have required doing something prior to his retirement. And negligent retention, the question becomes one of, is the only thing that can be done is the termination of the employee. 2005, the last alleged complaint, which involves family members in unique circumstances that aren't pled here, but are evident from the letters. And should they have terminated him then? Or is that the only thing that could be done? Or, given the fact that nothing has occurred from 2005 up to his retirement, or anything pled after 2005, is that the only thing that could have been done? Suggest that that's not. And maintaining a license in and of itself, there are tens of thousands of Church of God ministers who retire that their licenses are not taken away from them. They either voluntarily give them up or they go through the church's polity in order to, in essence, defrock them and take away their license. So from the standpoint of taking away his license, that would have involved the church polity and getting into First Amendment issues and how that is done and when that is done. And that really is I would suggest to the court, an allegation that has no real bearing on the issue in the case.
Counsel, educate me here. The license comes from the state or the denomination?
From the denomination.
Then why is the First Amendment implicated? Where's the government action?
The government action would be involved in a court deciding whether or not the license should have been defrocked, whether or not there was negligent hiring or negligent retention.
Well, counsel, no. I mean, I'm asking if the denomination says we are taking away your license. For good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all. That does not involve the First Amendment. And then courts know when to get involved with denominational matters and when not to get involved with denominational matters. We do it all the time. We make that determination all the time. I'm not following your First Amendment argument.
It only applies if an action would go forward alleging that there was negligent hiring, negligent retention, and whether or not a decision could be made as to whether the Church of God should have defrocked King or not defrocked him based upon negligent hiring, negligent retention. That doesn't preclude, there's no constitutional issue if no court is involved and no case is involved.
So in this particular matter, when he retired with all of these strikes against him, you could have, the denomination could have suspended or eliminated his license, but chose not to. That's the only issue in front of us. We don't have a constitutional issue in front of us. Correct?
No, there's no constitutional issue in front of you at this time.
Okay.
I would only see, in a quick answer to your question, I would only suggest from 2005 until 2011, there are no allegations at all, no allegations after 2011.
Understood.
So we've got 11 years between 2005 and 2016 with nothing at all. Thank you.
Hold on just a moment. Justice Powell, did he adequately answer your question?
He did with Justice Mims' follow-up. He did, Counselor. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Cooley, your time has expired. Ms. Kang. You have 5 minutes.
You're muted. You're muted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I corrected it now. On behalf of Church of God, I would definitely incorporate the arguments made by Mr. Cooley on behalf of Virginia Church of God, as there are comparable issues by which we stand in the same shoes. As to Church of God, they are the national / international organization, and as have elicited, they do provide the minister's license and did provide the minister's license to King, Pastor King, back in 1967. His license was not adversely acted upon, but I think the simple facts, and this goes to appellant's argument that they should have had the opportunity to amend, no matter what they do, frankly, the facts and the inferences are relatively simple in that the incident occurred in 2016. So at 2016, at that point, other than the fact that he was still maintained his license, there was not control over his actions at his home during a social visit by Jane Doe and her mother, who went there to deliver tomatoes. King was not in the midst with the Doe in providing any spiritual counseling or any such matters that may arguably flow to activities as a minister, whether or not he has his license. And I would...
But counsel, this is Justice Kelsey, but let me interject. Give me the shortest response you can to this idea. We're doing a pure pleadings analysis. We're not doing a real summary judgment. There are no interrogatory answers. There are no quest for admission. We're just looking at pleadings because that's all the trial judge did. Two, the pleadings allege post-retirement employment. They flat out say that. That could be completely true. It could be sanctionably false. I have no idea looking at the pleadings. Three, if they allege post-retirement employment, all of our recent cases point out that there's an inference in law of scope of employment, and that has to be rebutted. It can be rebutted actually within the text of the pleading itself, or it can be rebutted at trial. So if the sequences of those premises are correct, why is this not an easy question on the vicarious liability issues for us? It's going to be an incredibly hard question later in trial court.
Your Honor, I believe that we can agree that there is no employment relationship. So when you get to a potential agency relationship.
No, I may have misspoken. I hope I didn't. They are alleging an employment relationship, are they not? Post-retirement?
They are. They are alleging.
Okay, so isn't that a factual allegation? Why don't we just find out if it's true?
Well, Your
Honor,
requires
some sort of evidence.
If you look at the factual allegations and the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the factual allegations, we know that he did retire in 2011. So the one allegation that they contend that he continued to, that he still had his active license and he continued to provide spiritual counseling. When you get to the actual incident, he was not involved in any of those aspects, admittedly, based in
But but to cut to the chase, those are scope of employment issues. They're not employment versus non-employment issues. And the inference of scope under pleading rules, but not under evidentiary rules, comes from the employment allegation. I mean, that was the holding of opinion.
Your Honor, I do believe that you would still, the individual would still need to be subject to the control of the organization to be able to impose liability.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't the fact that one is licensed by an organization indicate that that organization can control them? Don't those two things go hand in hand?
Your Honor, certainly the organization could inactivate his license or terminate his license. But is that basically inconsequential? Because even if the organization does that, you would need to provide notice to the thousands and thousands and thousands of former congregants since 1967 for it to have any type of consequence, which is impractical and obviously virtually impossible. And it would be the same as a lawyer or a teacher or a nurse to impose liability flowing from when they were licensed all the way, giving it an unlimited perspective, is far too broad for this court to establish that type of precedent that could filter into many, many different professions. So, in other words, in short, I believe the fact that he had an active license is of no bearing on the factual allegations and the reasonable inferences that were contained in the amended complaint.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm going to push back a little bit against that. With lawyers and doctors and people of that nature, the state provides the license, and the license is what permits you to act in the present. You cannot legally act in the present without the license. Now, here it is essentially the imprimatur of the denomination, saying that that we continue to essentially stand behind you. We continue to allow you to hold yourself out as a trusted member of this denomination's local leadership. And so you may have other analogies, and I want to give you the opportunity, but lawyers, doctors, accountants, etc., just isn't convincing.
Thank you, Your Honor. It creates a circumstance where if a minister retains his active license, then it would impose some type of duty for the organization to basically be aware of all the facts and all the potential areas where this person can and should be, perhaps, disciplined after the person's employment ends. So we know that King retired in 2011. So for the court, for an organization such as Church of God to have to continue to monitor, this is basically a public policy argument, Your Honor, that I'm seeking to raise as to the impossibility of the task. And then when we look at the Does, I think their argument is basically that they met King when he was a pastor. The fact that this incident occurred afterwards, even if the organization had done something with his license, the Does were not there on the day of the incident having anything to do with his license. It was a social visit.
Counsel, you just put your finger on the problem. And that is when you said you think this is their argument. Because of the posture of this case, we don't know their argument.
But we know the facts that they have alleged, Your Honor, and we know the reasonable inferences. So based on the simple facts, this occurred 5 years after he was retired, 44 years after he became a Church of God minister. Ms. Doe was 9 years old at the time he retired as a pastor. So we do know these various facts from the pleadings and we can determine what our reasonable inference is when this court is ruling on a demur. And that's what I would argue based on the facts, based on the simple facts, and based on the reasonable inferences. You don't get to, under any theory, any theory which would impose liability on Church of God for the actions of King or of direct negligence for hiring detention.
Thank you, Counsel.
All right, thank you, Counsel.